what's supposed to be happening as you grow up is you hit different milestones at different ages. You know, your brain gets bigger, maybe your heart gets bigger, and you can process, and you know, you're supposed to have support around this. You're supposed to have feedback and people tracking you, you know, and you're able to get through hard things because you have the structure for that. When the hard thing never goes away, hello, CPTSD, and hello, these coping mechanisms, and you freeze at that age. So the first age that I would say I probably ended up, you know, kind of freezing at was somewhere around like 7 or 8. And then emotionally, I'm not like intellectually, I'm growing, like my brain is still doing great things in the classroom, but emotionally that was it.
Coping skills, coping mechanisms, what the heck? Oh my goodness. Jenny has fallen deep into the coping skills vibes after her trip to the crisis stabilization unit, and you know she and Trey just have to dish it out. We talk about the origin and function of coping, the 6 types of coping, functional versus maladaptive, and skills versus mechanisms. Then, of course, we have to make it personal and delve into ourselves and, you guessed it, our trauma. Come blow bubbles with us on this hopefully hopeful episode of Light in the Fog.
Hello, my dear. Hello, meow, meow.
Hello, my collection of coping mechanisms.
Yay. Today we are talking about coping mechanisms.
Yay.
And I just want to toot my own horn for a second and say I've started a mental health grimoire. It says my garden on it, from a quote from one of my friends that says, water the garden and the bees will come.
Oh, I like,
you know,
that.
Yeah, it's really, really nice.
I prefer that to that quote of, you know, which wolf do you feed? Which kind of has like the shadow rah, rah, yeah, built into it. And it freaks me out every time I hear it.
Yeah, that one's a lot more like imposing, I feel like, than just water your flowers and the bees, yay, will come.
Yay. The bees will save us all.
Yeah. And the idea behind it being that when things are getting bad for me, I have a hard time knowing which way is up. And so it's nice for me to have a book to just refer back to of like, oh, things are bad, let's look into my book. And one of the most important pages in there that I flip to regularly is my coping skills page.
Yay.
And so today we are going to talk about coping skills and go ahead, Trey. I thought you were about to say something.
Oh, I was huzzahing that. And then I was also thinking coping skills are different than coping mechanisms, which we'll also have to talk about.
I have never thought about that distinction before. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the things that Trey and I both know that is important to mention about coping in general is that there's positive and negative forms of it. And that's really the key as well behind understanding coping skills in my book. So I don't know. I feel like a good place to start is to just mention what I understand the 6 kinds of coping skills to be. And I will say, I think it's okay to mention them off the bat because they're not all inherently positive. I will just say there are 6 types. And the 6 types are distraction, grounding, emotional release, thought challenge, access higher self, and self-love.
Aw, that's lovely.
Yeah.
That's a lovely list.
And
when I think about my coping mechanisms, all 2,000 of them, almost none of them
fit those 6.
Hence the difference between coping mechanisms, which is, you know, something that you create as usually as a kid because you're living in an unhealthy, toxic, abusive situation. And as a kid, like, you don't have the skills to deal with that. So you create like a machine, a program, a mechanism in order to make the thing that shouldn't be happening like okay.
Mm-hmm.
To endure. So that's why I see them as different. One is a wolf, one is a bee.
Yeah, I really like that distinction. And I think, you know, it definitely rests in the the phrasing of it, because, you know, a skill is something that you develop, that you are intentionally honing, you know, you're sharpening your skill claws, versus a mechanism, which is something that might already be in place. And I do think, especially the distraction piece, I think a lot of coping mechanisms can fall under that. Or like thought challenge being like you're keeping your brain running and you're keeping your brain moving so that it's not thinking about the other things. Mm. So that's a good point. But yeah, let's start with coping mechanisms first.
Coping mechanisms, yeah. Yes. But I am obsessed with your grimoire, so we will return back to that.
Yeah.
So I have a joke with a friend of mine that I don't actually have a personality. What I have is a loosely stitched together grouping of coping mechanisms.
I've heard that joke.
Joke, because Gen X, that's funny, right? Yeah, that's funny. We had, she and I have been on, you know, the unpacking of our trauma journey together for over 10 years. And we, you know, one of the things that we do as friends is we kind of spot each other, that when we see the other one leaning into one of these mechanisms, you know, we can just be like, hey, so here's the thing, you know, you're drinking a lot right now. Mm-hmm. You seem really, really angry these days, and I haven't seen you angry in a while. So like, what, you know, what is that anger doing for you? And I don't mean like, you know, like, oh, that color purple, what's that doing for you? I mean, like, literally, like the anger came up for a reason, because like the little kid in you needed that coping mechanism in order to deal with whatever was happening in our life. The bummer, so this sounds all great, except for most of the coping mechanisms you come up with when you're a little kid tend to be pretty bad.
Especially if like the example you have as parents, like if your parental example isn't necessarily the most shining, because that's 9 times out of 10 where you're learning some of these coping mechanisms from, is the adults that are in your life. So yeah.
Yeah. You know, my dad was, oh my goodness, he was an overworker. And it all went back to his PTSD. So there were times where he would have like 3 jobs and just like sleep in his car for an hour in between jobs. And then he would brag about it and be like, me and Albert Einstein, we only need 3 hours of sleep a night. And I'm like, you only sleep 3 hours a night because you have night terrors from being in the jungle, man. Like this is not something to brag about, but we often do, because we're like, look at how tough we are. Like, I'm so strong, you know, I'm so hard. At least that's what the Gen X thing was, is to be tougher than the world around us, even if it meant putting ourselves into really, I don't know, like sad and bad emotional positions where we weren't actually processing anything. We were just enduring. And gosh, I'm so tired of just enduring. How about you?
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, a really big key thing there is Albert Einstein was not a happy freaking person. You know, like, find me one photo of that man smiling, please.
Oh, hey now. I heard Al was a delightful dinner party guest. I think that he didn't sleep because his brain was so active. But then it's like,
oh, yeah.
Was Albert Einstein, did he have ADHD? Like, what was it that kept his brain moving so much that he literally, and you know, we think like, oh, he's a prodigy, he's once in a generation. But I'm like, well, but no, he just happened to figure out how to focus his particular neuro diversity issue in a, what ended up being, it could have very easily have not been productive. He mm-hmm. could have not discovered the physics stuff that he did. He got lucky.
I mean, his brain was definitely different. And I feel like when we're looking at, you know, coping mechanisms that are negative, or I've also heard maladaptive coping skills.
Maladaptive, such a sexy word.
Yeah, such a fancy big word to say that you are coping with things poorly. I feel like a lot of it, you know, when you were talking, something that came up is a lot of it comes back to priorities, you know, where it's like, especially for Gen Xers, we talked about this idea of peace of mind before. I don't know if we've talked about it on this, but we have talked about it on this podcast. And I feel like that's not really been a priority for a lot up until now. And so your coping skills haven't been to keep yourself at a peace of mind, they've been to keep yourself busy and active, you know, and keep yourself in the cog and in the system. And I feel like that's a really important switch that has to be made. Cause yeah, like all of my maladaptive coping skills, all of my poor coping mechanisms that I developed growing up were just to keep myself there and alive and active and not necessarily make myself happy at all.
Oh, that's such a huge, huge point. Holy Toledo. Mm-hmm. Happiness is just not even a consideration when you're growing up in that kind of a situation. It's just survive, survive, survive.
Well, and it's an idea that hasn't really been passed down generation to generation that much until maybe recently. And I don't know, maybe, you know, Sally Sue's listening to this and her family's been really great about instilling happiness into her bloodline. And I'm really happy to hear that. But like,
no, in general, Sally Sue, how dare you?
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's really interesting. And I don't know if we want to just bridge into some of our maladaptive coping skills, if that's going to be
helpful. Oh my God, yes. Like, let's be vulnerable, shall we? I do want to say one thing before we dive into it. So, you know, the psychology behind a lot of this is, okay, you're in a toxic environment that doesn't make sense to you because, you know, you don't feel good. Literally, as a little kid, you just don't feel safe. You don't feel loved. You don't feel whatever those positive things that Sally Sue is doing for her kids. You don't have that, but you don't know that you don't have that. So you're just trying to make sense of a strange world. So, you know, maybe you have a parent who, you know, says that they love you, but then they do horrible things to you, and your little kid brain has to make sense of that somehow. And that's really the birthplace of the coping mechanisms. But the bummer is that the, and this isn't me, this is my research speaking, that the age at which you start using your coping mechanisms, you kind of freeze because what's supposed to be happening as you grow up is you hit different milestones at different ages. You know, your brain gets bigger, maybe your heart gets bigger, and you can process, and you know, you're supposed to have support around this. You're supposed to have feedback and people tracking you, you know, and you're able to get through hard things because you have the structure for that. When the hard thing never goes away, hello, CPTSD, and hello, these coping mechanisms, and you freeze at that age. So the first age that I would say I probably ended up, you know, kind of freezing at was somewhere around like 7 or 8. And then emotionally, I'm not like intellectually, I'm growing, like my brain is still doing great things in the classroom, but emotionally that was it. Could you track back in your own experience?
Yeah, I've definitely like spent a lot of time thinking about like, at what age did I stop being happy, you know? Because, like, I was definitely happy as a young kid, and then there was, like, the stopping point. And I think it was about the same, 6 or 7, maybe 7 or 8. Because I know, you know, late elementary school, early middle school is when it started to get really rough for me. And I don't remember what freaking age I was. But, yeah, and I agree. It's like, you know, your brain is growing and developing, and you're starting to process more about the world and process more about your surroundings and your situation. And maybe you're starting to piece things together better, but because the pieces that you have are kind of crappy and like not very good, the puzzle that you're putting together isn't a very happy one. Yeah. And so then you're just like, oh, I have to start coping with this. And start doing things.
Yeah. And then the good news is that, you know, like maybe something will change in your world. You know, maybe you'll move to a different school and you get treated better, or your parents get divorced and there's less tension at the house. I'm definitely one of those people that says like divorce is usually like nobody divorces casually, man. And it's usually ultimately better. It's traumatic, but ultimately it ends up being better. At least that toxic situation is gone. Now, if the parent goes and marries the same thing again, you got yourself the same problem.
One of them is going to do it.
and like twice more, but then that third marriage usually is the one where they're like, got it. Now I understand what I'm supposed to be doing. But you know, there's these opportunities to grow emotionally. Maybe you get a mentor, maybe you get a mentor, maybe you get a best friend, you know, who is amazing mm-hmm. and great and gives you a safe place to be. So there are opportunities where you don't stay at, you know, 6, 7, 8 or whatever your freeze age is, but you're now catching up. So you're now trying to get to, you know, if it was 12 years old, it's a race to emotionally hit that point. But then the other fun thing that often happens with people with trauma is we end up in an addiction, a coping mechanism. Yeah. That is like one of our main go-to solutions, right? And then guess what? The day that your addiction kicks off, you freeze emotionally at that age again. Mm-hmm. So if you're able to get sober, you don't come in sober at, you know, 25 or 35 or 45 or whatever that age is. You emotionally come in sober at the age that you started your addiction off. Wow. Oh, man.
I feel like that also probably has a different scale depending on what the addiction is. You know, if it's a food addiction versus like alcohol versus like hard drugs versus like cigarettes. But then that also plays into when are you going to stop that addiction? But I feel like the emotional freezing is still a big point on all of those. That's really interesting. I never thought about it that way before.
I'm interested in like the smoking one, because I feel like smoking, like I always get this picture of just ennui, you know, like I'm already 105, darling. So does different addictions, bring in different emotional landscapes, you know, so there's over-exercising, just like there's overeating, there's overworking. And now that you're in a workplace, like emotionally, does the workplace kind of parent you and grow you up? And if it's a great workplace, then wonderful. And if it's a, you know, horrible, toxic one, then it's creating more trauma. That's so interesting, Jenny. I might have to go and do some research into that.
Well,
what's the best addiction to have?
I thought about it because like, I think part of it is also the social acceptance, in that if your addiction is getting you either socially isolated from your family or from your friends groups, or is getting you into social crowds that aren't helping you grow emotionally, I feel like that's part of it. You know, like smoking cigarettes at 22 is very different than smoking cigarettes at 12, you know? And
unless you're French.
Well, unless you're French.
Sorry, edit that out. Sorry, my French friends.
But like, you know, like some of these coping skills are quote unquote socially acceptable or socially passable, you know, where it's like, oh, the kid who overeats, they just are growing. They eat a lot. You know, it's not necessarily going to isolate you from anything. And you're definitely not going to find out the effects of it until much, much later. Yeah. Versus like getting addicted to hard drugs. Suddenly that's going to isolate you from your family. That's going to isolate you from your more positive friends that are in your life. That's going to isolate you into more negative spaces and negative communities at a younger age, which might contribute to that freezing that you're talking about, where it's like, oh, you're no longer growing because you're not allowed around people who are helping you grow. Yeah.
Where every minute of every day is really, you know, feeding the beast, and that beast is all about self-destruction. And then at some point we start self-isolating, you know, mm-hmm. we start removing ourselves because of the shame, you know, that we mm-hmm. can't be normal, that we can't do the things that we're supposed to do, that our society, our family, our friends are doing. So we remove ourselves entirely. So even if we did have good influences and good supports, the addiction can really drive everything. Man, this is a downer. Like, oh, geez, I didn't know that.
It's okay. We'll bring it back at the end. It'll end on a positive note. We promise.
So let's talk about some of our maladaptive. So I just started writing down some of mine, and I only got to 23 when I just like was done.
Only.
Just didn't want to carry on anymore. So I'm not going to go through all of them. I'll just hit some of the highlights. So when I was a kid, I spent most of my time in my room, and because I was hiding, because like my house was not safe. There was just, anyway, doesn't matter. It does matter, but it doesn't matter. She's my sister. She's my daughter. Anyway, I wrote. I wrote stories, and I started writing stories almost immediately upon discovering that putting these words together created sentences. By the time I was 13 or 14 years old, I had written 7 books. Now, you know, you'd be like, oh, prodigy, Albert Einstein, aren't you awesome? But y'all, I wasn't doing anything else. I was hiding in my room compulsively remaking the world. Wow. Talk about a coping mechanism.
Yeah. And
most of my stories were about found families. They were about not living on this planet. Thank you very much. You know, they were all very either sci-fi, or as I got older, they were more like teenagers who banded together because they, you know, they had nobody else kind of stuff. So everything that I was experiencing was coming out on the page, and you could say, well, you were processing, but you know what? I really wasn't. I cannot say that. And you, whenever anybody tells me, cause I've been at this therapy game for a long time, they're like, you should keep a journal. And I'm like, I'm going to punch you in the face, because journaling for a lot of people just re-triggers and re-triggers and re-triggers. Yep. So you have to be careful who you recommend this to. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that writing as a kid was a positive coping skill.
I agree. And I feel like it allows you, even if you're writing about what's going on, it allows you to exist in this headspace further.
Oh yeah. Disassociation, you know, coping mechanism number 2, simply not being present and accounted for. And this was something I didn't know I was doing until my 30s, because there wasn't language around it. And I just thought it was normal to always be daydreaming and to, you know, just not be present and accounted for in your body. And you did a lot of that too, you said.
Oh my gosh. All my entire childhood was disassociation. So yeah, absolutely. Just daydreaming galore. And I mean, it tied into ADHD a lot. But it also tied into just what was going on for me emotionally and mentally. And just that combination was just nightmarish for me. Yeah.
You sound like a Gen Xer. Stop hanging out with Gen Xers.
I'm done doing this podcast training.
Mic drop. I'm out. Yeah. So on the quote unquote positive side, one of the coping mechanisms I discovered was performance, overperforming. So, you know, getting really good grades at school, because that got me a certain kind of attention at home. Being part of the theater troupe, which was inevitable, please. No matter what, I was always going to be a theater kid. But I was really using it to get positive attention. At some point, you know, absolutely, because I was a Colorado teen, and I swear, like coming up in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, all Colorado teenagers smoked. I don't know what it was about that state.
Absolutely.
Didn't start drinking until college, but the overperformance, the overachiever thing was so calcified that I could be drunk every night and still get a 4.0 and still work a full-time job and still, you know, pay crazy bills because I was living in New York City and do all of these really high achieving things. But man, when I look at that, I'm like, that wasn't like, oh, look at you. You're a prodigy. It was just pure hysteria. Don't ever stop moving, man. Don't ever stop moving, because you might have to think or feel, God forbid. Yeah. Horrible. Yeah. And you're an overachiever.
Well, and I was going to say, like, because, you know, at the beginning I went over the 6 types of coping skills and you're like, none of those are mine. And I want to say, like, distraction being one of them, I think that is the most maladaptive, you know, the most prone to being a maladaptive coping skill of the 6. Because I do think there are times where you absolutely need to separate from what's going on for a little bit. But too much of any of the 6 type of coping skills is bad for you. You know, like if you self-love too much, you're a narcissist now. So it's like, I feel like distraction is the most prone in our society and the most accepted and the most, you know, malleable as well, but the most prevalent, where it's just like everybody's distracting all the time, usually.
Yeah. I mean, same, you know, phones and But before that, you know, I was raised by a TV set, and I'm not apologizing for it. It was the thing that kept me safe. Watching Wonder Woman kept me safe and sane.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, that ties into, you know, talking about some of my maladaptive coping skills. Distraction, distraction, distraction. I was watching movies all the frickin' time, man. All the time. And I didn't even realize how much I was actually watching movies until recently I started rewatching some of the movies that I watched a lot as a kid. And it was like, oh my gosh, like all the time I was watching this movie repeatedly, constantly.
Which one?
So my favorites are obviously, unfortunately, the Harry Potter movies had a very big impact on me growing up. Lord of the Rings movies as well were ones that I watched over and over and over again. There's a few others that are Triple X with Vin Diesel is one of my favorites.
Wow. By the way, I've seen that movie probably 5 or 6 times too. It's so the fur good. Coat. It just does it for me every time.
It's so good. I love that movie. It's so ridiculous. I know some of the animated movies like Madagascar or like Monsters, Inc., which, by the way, that movie in Heightened on Psychedelics is wonderful.
And which coping skill would that fit under?
Distraction. Yeah, I was watching movies constantly, and so I would say that was maladaptive for me. It did help form a lot of my brain. Obviously, it formed my love for film, because I was writing at a young age. Like, movies and writing just kind of started coming naturally. But man, I could not use writing to distract at all. The only kind of writing that I was doing was like poetry. That was really, really sad and really depressing, and it just like soaked in the emotions that I was going through, and it was gorgeous stuff, but like, oh my gosh, not helpful at all. Also
really?
Kind of
so
helpful.
You don't feel like you were processing, you don't feel like you were emptying the container?
You know, yes and no. I feel like there's something that I've come across recently that's talked about how people who verbally process their emotions, it's very, very helpful. But there is a point where you are over verbally processing. And when you are verbally processing, you're just soaking in it. You know, you're just allowing yourself to stay in it. You're not distracting enough, you know, and you're not pulling yourself out of that at all. And I definitely feel like that's what poetry was for me, was a form of rolling around in the grief, a form of like washing myself over with the grief, you know. I would listen to a really sad song and I would write really sad poetry. And sometimes I'd feel better afterwards, but sometimes I'd feel worse. And those emotions would just stick throughout the entire day.
That's what journaling was for me. I remember at some point, because I journaled from, I think 12 until maybe my first year in college or maybe just before that. And I would go back and I would read entries, and it was exactly what you're talking about. It was just like, just tremendous negativity and depression. And at some point I just said, I got really angry because rage is one of my go-to coping mechanisms. Not anymore. I'm way better, folks. Yay, therapy. But I got so angry at myself, and I was like, you know what? Until I have something good to say, I'm never writing in a journal again. And I closed it and I haven't opened it since.
Wow. Yeah, I really like that thought, because, man, it's hard sometimes. Also, the fact that you wrote books is absolutely insane, but I guess we're not necessarily talking about that today.
Oh, we'll talk storytelling at some point, for sure.
And then, you know, you mentioned the fact that I'm an overachiever. I didn't start becoming a good worker until my adult years, and so I was actually not performing well in school, and so it was the opposite, where I was just completely retreating into myself all the time and into lazy mode. You know, my mom withheld video games from me for a while, and I feel like that was helpful but also harmful, because then when I was old enough to buy my own system and get video games into my life, it's all I did. It's all I freaking did.
Overachiever. I'm sorry. Overachieving is not necessarily getting great, you know, good grades or doing well at work, to me, overachieving is just really, really, really throwing yourself into something and getting good at it. You were an overachiever when it comes to video games.
Yeah, I guess that's a way to put it. Yeah, absolutely. My mom would completely disagree with that definition of overachieving, but I agree. I was very good at video games and I got into them. And, you know, I could do a whole episode of video games because it's another form of storytelling. Yeah. But like, I feel like between books and movies and video games, I just became immersed in worlds that weren't my own, you know, and just constantly pulled me out. That's why I couldn't get into nonfiction books. It's because I was just reading fiction so much growing up and it's all I consumed. Because I don't want to read about the real world. I don't want to be reminded of this crap. Like, I want to, you know, read about dragons and this right. kid finding a blue egg that has a dragon inside of it, you know?
That's like, right. You know, and our society is so interesting that we are, you know, we're built for escapism in America. That's, you know, mm-hmm. our primary contribution to the planet, I think. And it's crazy because the origin of storytelling is very much about, like, you know, how to be a functioning, viable citizen in your society. So originally all these stories was really like, if I didn't know how to work something, which is most things, because I was 7 years old emotionally, like I would go and I would read books and I'd be like, oh, that's what I'm experiencing, or oh, that's a solution to it. So to say that immersing yourself in story is bad, is odd, because it really is one of, especially when you don't have parents or, you know, or adults who can come in and provide this education. Man, books is it. Movies are it. But you're right. They're in, like you said at the beginning, if you throw yourself too far into something, there's probably going to be some bad effects.
Well, I'm thinking about, like, returning to what you were saying earlier with the freezing. You know, I wasn't doing good in school. And I was dissociating with ADHD all the time. So I would go home, watch a movie. I'd spend the entire day, next day, thinking about that movie or thinking about that video game, thinking about going back to that book. I wouldn't be socializing with friends. I wouldn't be socializing and engaging with schoolwork. I'd be failing my classes. You know, all I cared about was the distraction. All I cared about was not living in my world. And it did form a self-hatred of kind, because I wasn't performing to the standards that I was supposed to be, you know? Plus I didn't, obviously also had gender dysphoria, so I didn't like my body. But like, yeah, it's crazy. Like, you know, I think I've learned a lot from stories and I'm a good person because of storytelling, and also it ruined my childhood a little bit.
Wow. That's amazing. I think that needs to be a t-shirt, because I imagine most writers can relate to that. I'm a better person because of storytelling, but it also ruined my childhood a little. Genius. Oh, thanks, man. Trey. Yeah, and it's the complexity of being human, right? You know, trying to pull out the good things and not letting our maladaptive pieces kind of ruin it for the rest of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, same thing with like over exercising. Man, there's nothing I love more than 3 hours in a gym. I used to, you know, like literally 6 days a week. And I thought it was because I lived in Los Angeles, because everybody works out a lot in LA. And I'd be down at the beach rollerblading most mornings, or, you know, doing yoga or Tai Bo, and got into martial arts like Krav Maga. I can disarm somebody with a hand grenade. I'm pretty proud of that. Wow. Your view of your place in the universe changes when you realize
absolutely no longer afraid of hand grenades. Wow.
Krav Maga, people. It's not messing around. But, you know, and I wasn't doing it to be thin. I never had the body type where I was going to be thin. It was a mm-hmm. place to put all of this, I don't know. I just felt like I had a lot of energy, and I enjoyed it, you know, and I enjoy manual labor, for goodness sakes. Love manual labor. Not so much anymore. I'm kind of aging out of all of that. And I never realized, that any of that was kind of problematic until I started hanging out with a friend of mine who was a recovering bulimic, who also was an over-exerciser. And it turns out that over-exerciser, you know, is a form of self-abuse.
Yep.
I never had that thought. Like I would go to a friend's house for the weekend and I wouldn't get to work out all, you know, the whole weekend. And like, I would feel horrible about it. I had tremendous anxiety and I would try to figure out how to get a workout in. Why? Also, we were drinking like fishes. It's not like you know, I was on a health kick. It was that I was addicted to exercise and it was part of whatever identity I was forming for myself. But it wasn't healthy. But it was.
Well, and it's one of those addictions that's socially acceptable, almost especially socially encouraged, you know, where it's like, oh my gosh, you're going to the gym regularly, like good for you, way to stay on top of your fitness. Like it's an addiction that people congratulate you for having almost, which is absolutely wild to think about. And yeah, but it is a form of self-harm. There was a post that I saw on social media recently that was like, self-harm, you think self-harm looks like this, but it can also look like, and it had a list of like 50 things that are considered self-harm. Man, that list was devastating to me.
Yeah, like, I was gonna say, oh, and going God. Through that list and checking it off is self-harm. So
yeah, absolutely. You're just like, oh my God, I have no idea that I've been self-harming my entire life.
Do you remember any of the...
Over-exercising was one of them. Overeating was one of them.
Sure.
I don't know. I'll see if I can find the list again and I'll send it to you if you really want.
Yeah, put it in the show notes.
Oh yeah. But I think it's the same for me with overeating where it's like, you know, it releases this dopamine and it absolutely gets you high, you know, and like they always talk about the runner's high with exercise. I absolutely think there is the marathon eater's high as well, where you just have eaten so much that you put yourself into like a food coma. And then you don't have to deal anymore. And you're just kind of stuck there the rest of the night and you're just going to slowly drift off to sleep soon. And then you're done, you know? So
because yeah, literally the biology is all the blood and all the body chemistry is now focusing on digestion. Mm-hmm. So you've figured out a way to turn off your brain.
Yeah, literally that's what it was. And, you know, looking at ADHD, I needed that extra dopamine because I wasn't getting it. So it makes sense, but also it was just pure distraction. It was like a good thing that I had of, oh, this tastes good. This is a good feeling. And it started being that I was just eating all the time, you know, I was like Brad Pitt in every one of his movies. Like I'm just constantly eating, you know, there was always something in my mouth, in my hands.
Oh man. All right. It's going to be in your contract when you're a filmmaker, like keep my favorite snack handy at all times.
Absolutely. And Moneyball is one of those movies that I watched over and over again as a teenager. And I rewatched that and I was like, wow, I've seen this movie thousands of times. But yeah, like truly, you know, just eating between classes, eating while I was in classes, you know, lunch was my favorite period of the day, and then just eating when I would get home. And it worsened my relationship between my mom and myself because she was the one buying all these groceries and this food that I was just plummeting through really quickly. So, you know.
And then the weird thing can happen where then the person who was supplying the thing that we abuse ourselves with then ridicules us or shames us for, you know, indulging, like, why can't you control yourself? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such
good times. This is taking me back. Let me tell you.
Well, and you bring up an interesting point because I know we're probably going to switch soon. Yeah, you bring up an interesting point of like the people who have encouraged these coping skills, you know, or who have fed these addictions, but have also discouraged them and been like mad at us when we do the addictions. I truly think that like, regardless of what your addiction was, it doesn't necessarily mean that you were better adjusted for it, you know? And, you know, some addictions fly under the radar for a long time. And like, yeah, it's okay because you're not losing your social life because of it. But also you're not dealing with it for decades now, you know, maybe longer. Maybe you're not dealing with it the rest of your life, you know, and over-exercising can kill you. Overeating can kill you.
Yes, to all of that in my big, I guess it's kind of a mission statement, but as a teacher, all of the classes I ever built to go teach always were coming from the same place, which is I want you to know the things that I took decades to learn and acquire. Like, why not go ahead and get it up front and deliver it to the next generation so that even if only 10% lands or 40% of it lands, it's still going to get you further down the road as a starting point than having years and years and years of ramping. And it's the same thing with, you know, with the healing stuff. Is I'm always saying this to my students. It's like, oh, please get into therapy in your 20s, because if you can figure your stuff out now, you get the rest of your life to be who you actually are, as opposed to being a dancing monkey in service to these coping mechanisms that your third grade self thought was a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's the whole reason we're doing this, or the whole reason I'm doing this podcast is I wish these are things that I had heard when I was your age, or had a chance to talk about. We'll put it that way.
Well, and these are conversations I wish that I was having as a kid with somebody, you know, and I think you bring up a really good point about therapy. I feel like when therapy hasn't worked for people, it's been a combination of wrong environment or wrong therapist, you know, and I feel like if you can work through, and obviously that's a bit generalizing and some things don't work for people at all, but I have a hard time believing that if you weren't to find the right person who was a good therapist and was to help you through the right things, that therapy wouldn't work for you. Like, I'm not saying you, but whoever's listening,
right?
You know, and like the younger you can start talk therapy, the better. Like, it truly helps you, but it's also really gatekept by finances, unfortunately. Yeah. And so it's not like one of those things you can do too much of, because it's like, how do you afford that?
Right.
You know?
Yes.
But yeah, I feel like that segues nicely into more positive coping skills.
Yeah.
And I think,
guess what? Therapy is available on YouTube, ladies and gentlemen. It may not be personalized, but when you start listening to some of these things and investigating, you know, what's resonating with you, you get to take on some of these, you know, skills, let's just call them skills. Mm-hmm. So the bees versus the wolves, that you can now start reprogramming your own darn brain. So even if you don't have the money, you don't have the insurance, you don't have the access, you can't find the right person, because it does take a while to find the right person. And you have to have that, you know, temerity to be willing to go through three or four different therapists to find them. And then find out that talk therapy isn't right for your kind of trauma. Whoops, mm-hmm. You got to do something else. But there's so many things out there. I mean, I feel like I spent years physically and I don't know what that word would be, mentally rewiring my brain before I was even ready for talk therapy. Y'all, yeah. I couldn't get words out of my mouth about my situation. I had to do 5 or 6 years of this other stuff first before I could even think about therapy. How about them apples? That sucks.
Yeah. Well, and it makes sense. And I know people like that who, you know, you can't process it verbally. Yeah, but there are resources regardless for people. You know,
there are.
It's just about accepting that you want to do better.
Or just accepting that you don't want to feel like this anymore. That's a great starting place.
That's an excellent starting place. And I feel like, you know, when you're looking at that shift between mechanism and skill, there has to be that intention behind it, number one, of you're purposefully doing this thing. And two, when I was learning about, because the coping skill knowledge that I have, I got from my time at Santa Fe House, which is a crisis stabilization unit. The big thing that I learned is not overdoing it, that all of these coping skills are negative if you do them too much, you know, and that every single coping skill that you can think of in the world, if you do too much of it, it's bad. it's now a bad coping skill. And so the idea being that you have a litany, a roster of coping skills that you can bounce between, you know, because like exercising for you, just because it was maladaptive doesn't mean you're never going to exercise again. Or maybe you don't, I don't know, but like maybe it's too much of an addiction. But like, you know, I feel like getting into that middle ground of like, oh, I only watch a movie once or twice a week now. It's still a very healthy coping skill for me to have as long as I'm not doing it for 12 hours. If I am, it's only once a month. So like,
you know, it's a treat and then it's a reward, you know?
Exactly. Or like food. I obviously can't stop eating. I need to eat. And so instead of shifting, oh, well, I need to eat to feel better, let's cook myself something to feel better, you know, and now I'm cooking food and I have intention behind it. There's also a set amount of that food that I'm allowed to eat. And after it's gone. And so I think what makes the shift between mechanism to skill is just allowing it to exist as it's healthy. And then when it stops being healthy, you stop doing it, you know, and you move on to something else. Because not every coping skill is always going to work. And sometimes things get bad.
Right. And a lot of times we don't know when things have slid into unhealthy, just like, you know, with PTSD. I never really knew when I had triggered, and it would take a compilation of the greatest hits of symptoms before I would be like, oh, hey, I'm completely messed up right now. Or maybe a friend would point out, you know, whatever. So to not put the pressure on yourself that you have to recognize the line between healthy and unhealthy, to me, it's about changing the relationship with the thing and then trusting that, you know, in the past, if you did portion control and that, you know, that made you feel good, your body was getting the nutrients, you know, that it needed, et cetera, then you can trust that portion control is a good thing and will continue to be a good thing, versus you knowing what portion you need. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would agree. And I also think, you know, redirecting back to the fact that there's to the six different kinds of coping skills, I think maintaining a balance between the six is really, really important, because that will also help you to not overdo it, you know, and understanding that, oh, I spend a lot of time in distraction. Maybe I need to go back to accessing my higher self a little bit more. And I've done a lot of distraction this week. How can I do some accessing my higher self? Or I'm somebody who emotionally releases a lot. And there is such a thing as too much emotional release, you know, and you kind of have to ground yourself and go back into grounding. Mm-hmm. And so I think,
can you relist the six again, just to refresh our memories?
So I'll send a link if I can to the six, but there's distraction. So for example, you know, addictions usually fall under distraction, or listening to music or going to see a movie. There's
falling in love, like needing to date, comes to mind.
Grounding is one of them. So yoga, feeding the ducks is one of my grounding exercises that I have. Blowing bubbles is another one that I really like. It's the super grounding.
What is that?
Blowing bubbles, like, you know, like the bubbles that you have that you dip in the water and you blow them.
Oh, it's like a straw, like using a straw, just blowing air through the straw?
No, like bubbles that kids have, you know, like that are made out of soap and water. Dip the wand in and then you blow the bubbles. And one of the things I really like about blowing bubbles is it's intending your breathing, where it's like you are purposely breathing a certain way and you're focusing on your breathing, and you get a reward for how
you breathe. Do.
Yeah. Bubbles. And they're so whimsy. Emotional release. So, you know, crying, screaming, letting your anger out, going on a drive and on the highway and just screaming your guts out in your car.
Also singing.
Yes.
There can be other, like more positive emotional releases.
Well, and I don't think screaming your guts out in a car is necessarily a negative thing. I think that can be very healthy. Thought challenge. So reading, writing poetry, doing Sudoku, people who have math as a coping skill, like that's considered to be thought challenge. Accessing higher self. So I would say that usually feeds into theology a little bit more. You know, if you go to church, or if you're like us and you do witchcraft, you know, just accessing, I really like that access higher self as a category for coping skills, because I think that's really interesting.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, meditation.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my jam.
Absolutely.
It's all about meditation.
And then the last one is self-love. So, you know, spending time with somebody that makes you feel appreciated, writing yourself a love note, you know, taking a shower, cleaning your house, cleaning your room. Those are things that I would be considered self-love, you know, is taking care of yourself intentionally. And I think when you can spend a good amount of time in each of these coping skills, you're going to find that you are not overdoing it at all, you know, where it's like, oh, I've done a lot of self-love this week. Let's do some distraction, you know.
There's only so many rooms of your house to clean.
Yeah, before you need to go out and watch a movie. Like, come on. But yeah, I really like those a lot. And I will also say that one of the things that I'm going to put in the link is these worksheets that I got from Santa Fe House. One is a list of 99 coping skills, and then there's 50 ways to take a break, and then there is 38 unusual coping skills.
Oh, I love it. Give us an example. Just pull like one or two off the 38 unusual ones.
Smell your dog.
Yes.
Because dogs smell like corn chips. Peel dried glue off of your hands. Play with rice. Play with warm, not hot candle wax. One of my favorites that I was going to do, which I think can help people who have sexual trauma, is to color in a vulgar adult coloring book, which is a lot of fun. Break glass at the recycling center was one of them. But the reason I'm going to put these in the show notes is because when I was at Santa Fe House, one of the group therapy sessions we did is we got these worksheets put in front of us, and she said, highlight the ones you like. And so what you're doing now is this is a list of nearly 200 coping skills, and you're going to walk away with at least 20, you know? So now it's not just like, oh my gosh, I have one coping skill or two coping skills. It's like, I have freaking 20. I have like a list of things that I enjoy doing or things that I want to try doing, because not all of them are going to work in the moment, but having an entire roster of things that you like to do just written down somewhere and knowing within yourself is really, really freaking helpful. Oh my gosh. I recommend it for everybody. But yeah, I'll put those in the links. I found them online.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I remember when you told me about these, my mind was blown, you know, because I feel like so much of our evolution is just cobbling things together. You know, when everybody started making bread during the COVID sequester, it was 1,000% a coping skill. Mm-hmm. And because one person did it, then it gave somebody else the idea to do it. And to me, it's both it's a distraction, but it's also a thought puzzle because, you know, you have to engage. It's a living thing, blah, blah, blah. And part of it, what's of interest to me, is it's an interrupter, right? So
yes.
It's meant to stop you from going down whatever road. Like if you're starting to recognize that you're spiraling, you know, you hear about like the tapping thing, like getting back into your body, you know, picking out five things in the room, right? So these are all variations of these kinds of therapeutic things. But what's really wonderful about some of these things is the more you do them, the more your nervous system will recognize that, that's the happy place. Mm-hmm. And so you can literally train your nervous system that when you handle warm wax, it will catch up faster, and mm-hmm. then you can get out of whatever that negative spiral was like really quick. And this is a lot of people talk about, you know, meditation, it's too hard. I can't get my brain to slow down. Well, then handle warm wax while you do it. Mm-hmm. Train your brain and your body, you know, to recognize that this is the time where everything's just going to settle down, man, and just chill out. Like you'll get there. And look, there's 38 really unusual things that you can do to help jumpstart the process.
Well, and I noticed that, you know, particularly with me blowing bubbles more, when I was going outside to blow bubbles when I was stressed, I started smoking less, you know, because it's like, oh, it's this outside activity to do. It involves breath work still, and it involves release. And man, there's nothing better than just sitting and blowing bubbles for 20 minutes and watching all your bubbles hit the sky and pop. And you're just like, wow, I feel so much better than I did. So yeah.
That's a genius one.
Mm-hmm. I really like that one a lot.
Yay. Blowing bubbles. Maybe that's the title of this episode. Oh,
that's such a pretty title for such a sad episode.
Well, this wasn't nearly as depressing or, I don't know, disturbing as I thought it might be. So as always, lovely, lovely, lovely to get to share these things with you. Thanks for being willing.
Thank you so much. I'm glad we did a coping skills episode. For our audience, I do, you know, I encourage you to just find those links through the descriptions and print them out and do your own coping skills list. I think everybody should do it. It's very, very helpful, no matter who you are. But as always, thank you so much for listening.
Cheers.
Cheers. Meow, meow. Meow, meow.